I think that it would be a good idea to tell the patient that, you know, you don't do this enthusiastically, and that you really don't think it's a good idea on a lot of grounds, and throw in the medical grounds as well. But I certainly think that as far as new patients are concerned, that you ought to make it very clear that you prefer not to be involved in these things. Essentially, what's involved is somebody else writing the prescription instead of you. And you can, in this case, have your cake and eat it too. Register disapproval when the patient walks out of the office with a prescription. I don't see any objection telling the patient, look, I don't write the prescription, but next door they do. The patient will get the prescription and gotten the little homily at the same time. I see that as quite different from an abortion.
You're talking about actually sending the patient to another physician. You're not talking about having another physician write the prescription for the patient who's in your office at that time.
Let's put it this way. Again, this isn't halacha. This is policy. New patients, I don't think I would write the prescription for. But I'd tell them that you can get the prescription.
I understand, but I'm saying that's not satisfied by getting the prescription within the same visit from another physician that's writing. You're talking about sending that patient now to become the patient of another physician.
I don't think that you have to send the patient to become the patient of another physician. In effect, the physician will learn very quickly that all he has to do is sign his name to a prescription pad. I mean, in effect, what you're telling the patient is that I can take care of all your needs. The one thing I'm not going to do for you is write prescriptions. The patient will then go to somebody else in the same group practice and get the prescription.
No, the patient will want to change doctors. The patient will want to go to another physician who can take care of all the needs, and she doesn't have to go back and forth and have any complications.
Really?
And that's true. And not only that, but there's a significant proportion of patients in our practice, basically about the same practice. I'd say probably a couple of percentage points. We're dealing with young, healthy women who have decided they want to be on birth control pills. And so far, we've been prescribing them. Well,
what do the Catholic doctors in that group do? Or aren't there any?
We certainly don't have any in our particular department, so these things have never been discussed.
That's from the hospital.
I was going to suggest this. I remember an OBGYN, this is 10 years ago, I was straight out of the yeshiva, made his acquaintance, he had kids in our school, and in the discussion with him, abortion came up. I asked him, you know, do you perform abortions? He says, yes. I said, don't you know that Jews are not supposed to perform abortions? Yeah, but you know how it is. And that was the discussion. A couple of years later, he changed his practice to a different office, and he tells me, Shestam, you'll be happy to know that I don't do abortions anymore. I said, Baruch Hashem, you know, how come, what happened? Well, I got a new associate, he's Catholic. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I looked at him again, and he knew what the message was.
Yes, of course. Precisely.
We have to learn our moral standards from Catholics, and we have to learn from us.
Well, it depends what you count for.
Yeah. Why should you write that?
If you use surrogate partners in your counseling, of course it's objectionable. If you are counseling people to overcome impediments, then...
Later, is a sperm count allowed, and how do you recommend it be done?
Depends for what purpose. The sperm count is part of a fertility workup.
Is that who wrote, sperm count allowed? Is that?
Yeah.
For a fertility workup. Yes.
Yes. The sperm count can be done, preferably by retrieval from the vagina after intercourse, if possible. Now, I understand that medically you can't get an accurate sperm count that way, but I'm at a loss to know why clinically it makes very much difference whether you get an accurate count or not. Basically, if I understand it correctly, about the only treatment that you have, well, you can find out one of two things. You can find out that the husband is perfectly fecund, and it's just an accident that the wife hasn't gotten pregnant, in which case you send them home. That's highly unlikely. What you really want to find out is whether it's moderate male infertility or whether there are just no little sperm floating around. Even in a post-vaginal examination, a post-coital examination, you will determine whether or not there are no sperm present. In other words, if he is totally sterile, that will show up immediately. If he is only moderately sterile, it seems to me that to you it makes no difference what the count is. Now, I say that to you it makes no difference because if you're dealing with a low count, most urologists out there will tell the husband, forget about it, adopt a child, or use artificial insemination. You are not going to say that. You're going to tell the patient to combine ejaculates and to attempt AIH no matter how little or how remote the chances of success may be.
There,
artificial insemination using the husband as the donor. Therefore, it seems to me that an accurate sperm count isn't terribly significant.
It may help you determine whether it's the husband's problem, quote, or the wife's.
Well, again, whether it's the wife's problem or not, you're not going to find out until you do a workup on her. It's easier to do the workup on the husband. That's why you do him first.
Right.
Right? I don't think that that's how it should be done necessarily. I think you should do the female workup first. But that's not the greatest problem. If you have reason to suspect that the male is not fertile, then I don't understand what difference it makes to you other than in determining whether there are any sperm present. That's significant. If there are no sperm present, you're not going to combine ejaculates. If there are sperm present, then what aces do you have? What do you got up your bag? You'll tell him not to take hot baths before intercourse to make sure that he has as many sperm as possible. Then you'll tell him to combine ejaculates so that you will get the highest count and hope that she becomes pregnant. Beyond that, the only thing left is in vitro fertilization. What difference does it make whether he's got a count of 50 million per cc or 70 million per cc? Out there, it makes a difference. I don't know if I got the numbers right, but 70 million, they'll try combining ejaculates, and 40, they won't bother. They'll say it doesn't pay. Now, it may not pay statistically, but if you're a Jewish physician advising a Jewish couple and telling them that they've got to do whatever they can or that this is the only method available to them to have children, then you are going to combine ejaculates, even if they're only 10 million per cc. And there has been success, incidentally, even though it sounds very low. But there are people who have been persistent, they persevere, and it has resulted in conception. So that an accurate sperm count isn't going to make any difference. It is going to make a difference whether there are sperm present or there are no sperm present. And to determine whether there are sperm present but in lower concentration or no sperm at all, that you can determine on a postcoital.
We talked about artificial insemination. Could you elaborate any more about that?
Okay. Artificial insemination involving retrieve from the vagina after intercourse. Artificial insemination involving a donor other than the husband is absolutely forbidden.
Wasn't there a tshuva by Rav Moshe?
He retracted it.
Was that because of a lot of pressure?
No, Rav Moshe doesn't retract anything under pressure. That's a canard. The man doesn't know what a word means.
That wasn't the opinion of Saul Berman on the tape.
I said earlier, I'm only responsible for myself.
But what was the purpose? Why did he retract it? Was there any reason given for the retract?
Well, what he had permitted was use of non-Jewish sperm.
Right.
Right, fine. And he retracted that subsequently.
Do we know why?
Yes and no. There are a number of problems involved. The basis for permitting a non-Jewish donor in the first place was based upon a kind of technical consideration, namely that while in general the one very significant factor auguring against AID is the fact that the identity of the father is not readily available. And it's also in halacha to have a wife in every port. You can't have a wife in every port because the children won't know who their father is, hence there may be incestuous union sometime down the road. In the case of a non-Jewish donor, that's not true because there is no paternal relationship between the non-Jewish donor and the child who is born as a result of AID. Now, that doesn't take into consideration a number of other considerations which are secondary in nature but not by any means totally to be rejected out of hand, including the parentage of a child. There may not be a technical issur involved, but there is a grave hesitation on a variety of grounds for creating a gene pool with non-Jewish genes. In effect, what Rav Moshe said was that while as in terms of strict halacha, there may not be a technical prohibition, but in the retraction, which is relatively brief, in effect what he says is that general policy considerations argue against permitting this type of practice, because there are enough other considerations that are important to us, and we don't want this to be done. Now, let me make one other point, and it's again a technical point, but I think it's a technical point which is philosophically of extreme importance. There is no mitzvah under the sun for any person to engage in heroic measures for purposes of siring a child. If you're dealing with a male who has moderate male infertility, there is no obligation whatsoever to combine ejaculates. He may want to do so because he wants to be a father. That's fine. You can accommodate him. But he's got no obligation to do so. There is no obligation on the part of a woman who is married to a man who is sterile to have a baby. She has no mitzvah whatsoever to have children. She may want them. We may want to gratify that desire. It may be a good idea to gratify that desire. But that desire doesn't counterbalance other considerations which militate against using non-Jewish sperm for purposes of artificial insemination. That's all part of what went into the retraction. I can assure you, Rav Moshe never, ever retracted anything under pressure. It doesn't happen.
Technically, how the pooling is done?
The pooling? Ask a doctor.
No, that's I would imagine this would bring up a halakhic
problem. Oh, you mean how do you obtain the sperm in the first place? There are many who permit even masturbation for that purpose. Again, I would prefer to see either post-coital retrieval or, if necessary, use of a condom for purposes of retrieval.
This same, just along the same lines, the same would apply to sperm banking. This is another issue when people, say males getting chemotherapy will become sterile. Mm-hmm. And there's an outside chance 10 years later this may reverse. But for all practical purposes, the sperm count will fall down to zero with most chemotherapy.
Yeah, it happens on leukemia in particular, right. Which affects young people, and they want to have sperm in the bank before.
So masturbation for this purpose is halakhically allowed?
Well, many permit even masturbation for this purpose. Again, it's no mitzvah at all.
Right.
There's no obligation on the young man's part to do any of this, but it's permissible in terms of halacha. The question is only the procurement.
Again, a condom would be a preference.
Definitely preferable.
I think we should take the question on snares because there's certain parts of it that are. In the general audience. For example, sometimes a rectal or vaginal examination may be considered only for completeness sake. Should this be avoided?
What does that mean? What do you mean for completeness sake?
There's something known as a problem-oriented medical record where your examination should be the same in every patient regardless of complaints, for example. Or patient was in an automobile accident and is complaining of symptoms to suggest a lower back condition, mm-hmm. except that there is no sign of spinal cord dysfunction yet. if you don't test rectal tone, there's one, that's one sign of spinal dysfunction, but you have no reason to suspect that's going to be abnormal. Should you avoid these things?
But good medicine makes you do this. You do this examination to rule it out, don't you? Mm-hmm.
Well, in many cases, you'll find doctors writing rectal deferred, even not for halakhic reasons.
Why is it deferred? I have heard tell that there are internists who give physical examinations to males in the 40, 50, 60 age bracket and don't do a rectal examination to examine for prostate. I mean, these guys are guilty of malpractice. That should be standard in a male of that age. That's the only way to diagnose cancer of the prostate. And a guy who doesn't do that...
The rectum.
Yeah, rectal examination.
Yeah, okay. So the rectum.
No, for the prostate.
Well, you reckon at that age.
Well,
really?
Fine.
We're not talking about the, you know, where there's a specific indication such as that. But for example, to take every patient with a low back condition and do a rectal examination.
Isn't this one of the things you have to do to rule out spinal involvement?
It'd be very unusual to see that.
What do you mean very unusual to see?
Examinations for low back condition do not include a rectal exam. Even though if you want it to be, you know, machmer, you probably could justify doing that.
Explain to me, medically, should this be done? Does it make sense to do it medically? Does a good doctor do this for medical reasons? As distinct from padding his...
Extremely thorough doctor would do it. The average physician would not.
I mean, the average physician is a schlamazer. I mean, you tell me that a thorough physician does. You tell me it's good medicine to do it, or am I misunderstanding? Am I right? Is it good medicine?
Yes.
It's good medicine to do it.
Well, why are other neurologists doing it? Is it for fear of criticism, and really medically it's not sound?
Are they doing it to prevent malpractice suits, or are they doing it for the patient?
They may actually be doing it for that reason.
Like maybe doing it to test.
I'm saying most physicians would not do that. Low back injury.
Ruben, what's the problem? What's the question?
The next question is going to be whether a male should do this on a female patient if it's not necessary. Yeah, and obviously, if it's not necessary, then don't do it. If she comes in with a toothache, we'll give her a vaginal exam.
What is the standard of care, though, with, say, an initial physical examination in an internist's office
A general physical exam.
Yeah, and if she doesn't have, say, a gynecologist who's just seen her...
If this woman has been to her gynecologist last week and it's not come to the internist, and the gynecologist did a pap smear, and he's not a schlamazel, and you respect him, you think he does a thorough job, I don't think you should repeat the pap smear. On general principle. You probably shouldn't repeat the vaginal examination unless you tell me that there are things that the gynecologists don't see on vaginal examination and you do. On the other hand, if the last time she saw a gynecologist was when she had her last baby 10 years ago, then it would be a good idea for you to do all of these things. And again, in your case, I don't know. I'm not a doctor. It depends. The woman who comes in with a toothache shouldn't be having a vaginal examination unless that's the only excuse that you're using to give her the physical that she needs anyway. If there's a cogent reason for doing this, and it is cogent, you know, it's not the toothache situation, then by all means do it. Again, I'm not answering you medically because I don't know the medical facts. In terms of halacha, if there's a good medical reason for it, by all means. If the reason is frivolous or non-existent, then of course not.
Let me put it in this way. Let's say there's a 1 in 10,000 chance that this would be abnormal.
I think 1 in 10,000 is enough reason to do this.
Okay. No. Move in, you got it. I'm going to check all your reports now.
I think we covered the... we may have covered the questions about under what conditions abortion and sterilization would be allowed. Completely. We talked about it.
How to act in practice. I think really it has relevance to the two of us in this room. What? As far as everyday practice, right, with just contraception. I'm still a little unclear on how I'm going to go and act after,
Especially since we didn't make the distinction yet in non-Jews and non-Jews in terms of birth control. Going back, I'm assuming that if it's not for a health reason, that in a non-Jewish, in a Jewish woman, it's prohibited under all circumstances.
Right.
Therefore, those women who are on it now would not be allowed the luxury of saying, I'm doing this, I don't feel comfortable, I don't like doing this, or whatever. That would have to be stopped.
As far as the non-Jewish women are concerned, again, it's what I call policy rather than halacha. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea, but I can't tell you the source.
And danger to a fetus is not in itself a reason for birth control. It has to be danger to the mother.
Well, danger to the fetus may be enough reason to use an IUD or a pill with another diaphragm.
Right.
But they're talking about using this across the board.
Danger to a fetus, you could use it. Huh?
Yes.
There's all kinds of other considerations, like practically how we see our role within the group and that kind of thing too. But generally, you've gone across the point that in general, l'chatchila, you shouldn't be dealing in these things.
I think so. Except when medically indicated.
Of course. Yeah.
Any hysteria for Kohanim to be doctors?
To be doctors, yes. To be medical students, no. If you could somehow become a doctor without being a medical student.
I think most of the other questions would be relevant to general needs, except this possibly to finish up about abortion and sterilization, under what conditions they would be allowed.
I can throw into that also prenatal amniocentesis. Not prenatal.
Amniocentesis.
Yeah.
All right. For what purpose? You know, you've used amniocentesis for a lot of different purposes. If you're doing it to find out whether it's a boy or a girl, I don't think that the risk of mortality or morbidity is warranted.
To find out genetic.
If you're doing it because there's some blood incompatibility, you may have to do an in utero transfer, fine. If you're doing it because you want to diagnose Tay-Sachs or Down syndrome and then do an abortion, then obviously there's no point to doing this unless you're going to go follow through and do the abortion.
Yeah.
So we're back to the abortion problem.
Okay.
All right. It seems, well, again, an abortion, when the pregnancy poses a threat to the life of the mother, is permissible. You will find some achronim who will be mater an abortion when the pregnancy poses a threat to maternal health. It seems to me that the majority of contemporary poskim would not permit it for maternal health. I don't think that there is any opinion that can be relied upon for anything less than that. And considerations of an abnormal, or fetal abnormality, don't qualify. Rabbi Waldenberg is the significant exception. He evoked vehement disagreement.
Does that depend on how far along the pregnancy is?
Well, again, I've ignored pregnancies within the first 40 days since amniocentesis can diagnose until at least the 12th week right now, right? So that makes no difference whether you draw the distinction between the first 40 days or you don't draw the distinction between the first 40 days, since you can't diagnose pregnancy in the 40 days anyway.
Within the first 40 days, is it generally held?
No, it's not generally held, but they're more matering during the first 40 days.
Because there's another question on this on the list, but menstrual extraction.
That you do for rape victims.
Pardon?
That you do for rape victims, right?
That or any woman who is menstrual period and wants to have this procedure done.
Oh, I see. You're doing it as birth control.
It doesn't go under that guise, because under the guise of why she missed the period. But
what do you mean why she missed the period? Because she's pregnant.
No. without doing the pregnancy test. Just done to induce the period.
Sure. That's called a euphemism.
Right.
Okay. that's not appropriate. In the case of a rape victim, there might be significant grounds for being mater menstrual obstruction. Since it's within the first 40 days.
Because of the psychological...
Well, no, those who permit it within the first 40 days maintain it's not a fetus in the first 40 days, hence there's no prohibition.
Remember, I'm not saying why a rape victim as opposed to...
birth control.
Anybody else.
General birth control.
Or abortion. No, you said for a rape victim it would be different. There would be a why is a rape victim different?
Why is a rape victim different from general birth control?
Birth.
All right. The only reason the rape victim is different from general birth control is the social stigma involved in bearing the child. That creates at least pain insofar as the mother is concerned. Sorry. Psychological anguish, which is certainly not in the category of pikuach nefesh, and would not warrant an abortion later in pregnancy for most bachurim. But if you maintain that there's no prohibition of feticide in the first 40 days, then the woman has no obligation to bear the child under those circumstances, and hence she has a right to eliminate the fetus within that limited period of time.
Would
that
be true for an unmarried
mother? You see, again, let me explain this a little bit more clearly. There are two things. First, the general obligation to bear a child. B, the prohibition against destroying the fetus. A woman who has been raped and doesn't discover she's pregnant until the sixth month has no obligation to bear the child. But she cannot destroy the fetus. The prohibition against destroying the fetus is quite different from the obligation to bear a child. If there's a prohibition against destroying the fetus, that's absolute. If you're dealing with a woman in the first 40 days, at which period for some achronim, there's no prohibition against destroying the fetus, and you add to that that she has no obligation to bear this child, then there's no objection to removing the developing zygote menstrual abstraction. Extraction.
Only from that smaller.
Right. As general birth control measures, it's obviously not permissible.
Right.
What about an unmarried woman? Wouldn't she also have perhaps a social stigma?
Of her own making.
Or perhaps society's making.
Perhaps.
So would the same thing be true during the first 40 days for those who mater, or who do not consider the...
Probably.
This.
I have a question and a comment. Comment is, I want to elaborate for a moment on what I said literally before, the difference between a question, a shiloh, and a problem.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what's being discussed here are not shilohs. The shiloh is answered quite clearly. The implementation of the shiloh in the context of your particular setting is a problem of the deer. Halacha can only go so far, and then what we call the fifth Shulchan Aruch has to take over. You have to know common sense and tact and sensitivity and to know how to implement it. That's just a comment. I have a shiloh.
I'm glad you have no problems.
In a different forum. We've dealt before with certain questions which are black and white in halakha, such as shaving during spira, yarmulke, things of that type. What about... Now that's a question on two levels. What about the obligation to appear dignified and menshish in the eyes of the patient, though it may not be important to you? It's not important to me as a doctor to have my shoes polished twice a week. I can get along with it once a month. As a yeshiva book, I got along quite well, but as long as I became a doctor, somehow, the conventional standards are that doctors' shoes are normally polished. What is my obligation to polish my shoes? That's a general question. And more specifically, in areas that I perceive as a chumrah, not a halachic obligation, a chumrah, such as, and I'll give you two simple examples, such as two machivim. According to Kabbalah, there are those who feel that you should always have your head covered not with one yarmulke, but with two coverings. Which is the chumrah, it has a certain place in Kabbalah. So I want to be a shtickle mekobo, but at the compromise for that is that I'm out of place, or along the same lines, the obligation to have whether a neatly kempt beard, which is better than shaving, but I feel that in my standards I
Beers are holy, and one should not touch one's beer.
Okay. I was going to ask you two questions. You answered them both. I was going to ask you, A, do you wear a beard, and B, do you wear a yarmulke? If the answers
are... about polishing shoes.
No. I'm going to answer about the polishing the shoes. If you don't wear a beard and don't wear a yarmulke, I don't think there's anything to talk about. As far as the patient is concerned, the patient doesn't know who you are and doesn't care who you are. When you wear a beard and a yarmulke, I think that there are very serious obligations. When you wear a yarmulke without a beard, I think there are also serious obligations, maybe not quite as serious. Let me start this way.
With a hat on top of my yarmulke, nobody knows I'm wearing yarmulke under my hat.
That's even worse. That's even worse. Let me begin this.
For the people in that crowd, we're among a Hamish group. This is not a purely hypothetical.
No, it's not hypothetical at all.
It's not
hypothetical. It'll be very concrete.
Not necessarily even a doctor.
The halacha of Talmud Chochem Shnim Suravavo Bigdoy, the type of dress that Talmud Chochem is supposed to wear. All the halachas that are cited by the Rambam in Hilchos Deis with regard to the comportment of Talmud Chochem and all the terrible things he says about the people who don't dress the way they're supposed to dress, the Dvar Hashem Boza, etc., and the Chil Hashem, all of that, seems to me to be predicated upon a definition of Talmud Chochem that doesn't have an application anyplace else in halacha. It seems to me that this is the one case in halacha where a Talmud Chochem is defined not in terms of how much he knows, but in what people think he is. No place else do you find this, and it seems to be very obvious, because all of this is in terms of social perception. What do those guys think? For whatever reason, a Talmud Chochem is not supposed to walk around with stains on his clothes. If they think he's a Talmud Chochem and he's not, it's the same Chil Hashem. The bottom line is the same. That means that everything in Hilchos Deis applies not to the guy who is a Talmud Chochem, but the guy whom people think is the Talmud Chochem. Fine. So now let's assume we have a doctor who doesn't know an aleph from a beis, but you guys got hold of him, and you didn't teach him aleph beis yet, but you taught him to grow a long beard. And since he's outside, and he happens to be a doctor, all the patients thinks that he is Elio Hanovi incarnate. Right? This fellow has all the chiyuvim of the Godel Hador in terms of his begodim, etc., etc. Now, I think he has to shine the shoes. I also think that he has to have, the beard's supposed to look nice. I don't know how you make it look nice, but I think it should. What else is left? I mean, I think all of this clearly applies.
What about your sphere?
What about sphere?
Is this just for doctors?
No.
Anybody who is perceived?
Anyone who is perceived as the personification of the ideal Jew. Now, the people out there, they look at the people dressed a certain way, who act a certain way, and they consider them to be Talmidei Chachamim. These are the elite, the Jewish elite. And that imposes a concomitant burden, regardless of the profession which the fellow happens to occupy himself.
Mm-hmm. What about two hats?
What do you mean by that? Two hats.
Should you wear a hat and a yarmulke when you examine a patient? Is there anything wrong with wearing a hat and a yarmulke when examining a patient?
I prefer gloves.
I don't know how to answer that. A hat and a yarmulke when examining a patient. I don't think that it will offend the patient the way dirty tzitz is hanging outside offends the patient. By the same token, it seems a little bit odd, queer.
California, be careful.
I'm sorry.
But
and again, you see, it's difficult for me to take it seriously, given that I'm a sniper.
Where's two yarmulkes?
I was about to suggest that, actually. Why not? Yeah, why not two yarmulkes, one larger than the other?
Bigger
yarmulkes. Yeah.
But it was a rhetorical question, but I wanted to hear a clear, definitive response to the halakhic.
My only hesitation was on two counts. A, Yeah, yeah, it hasn't quite sunk into me the significance of a hat over a hump. The snagit that I know. What I'm saying, in effect, is that that's the chumrah that doesn't send me. I really can't answer honestly because I don't know how to evaluate that impact on a patient. To be honest, while I don't advocate it, certainly, I'm not sure that the patient would react by saying dirty Jew. I think the patient is more likely to react by saying
strange.
And strange, what kind of doctor is it? Now, as a doctor, you know, it would be a plumber, would be a little bit different. But as I would kind of advise two yarmulkes.
But if a doctor should, for whatever reason, insist on wearing a hat, it would be his responsibility to brush that hat regularly.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's got to be a clean hat.
How about the patient saying it's not just strange, the doctor is strange, but strange, I guess, religion, Yiddishkeit, God are strange. Isn't it? That's the
strange.
No. No, 99% of the
After all, Yiddishkeit is strange to any goy, certainly, isn't it? That's not our concern. When the strangeness is legitimate and bona fide, then the goy will just have to put up with it. Now they're going to have to put up with our tzitzis and even with the beards, and they're certainly going to have to put up with the Lulav Nesrig that we march around, the Sukkot and all these things. It's strange, but they're going to have to put up with it. What they don't have to put up with is what A is not Yiddishkeit, and what B is worse than strange, but uncouth. A dirty hat. That's not strangeness. It goes beyond the strangeness. It's just dirty. And there's no reason for it. The Revav al Bigda is an example not of something that's strange, but on something that does reflect negatively upon anybody who walks around that way. Therefore, Talmud Chacham shouldn't walk around that way. And this isn't something that that will make Yiddishkeit more appealing to a non-Jew, and there's no reason to make it as unappealing as possible. You know, what we can't do anything about, we can't do anything about. But the spots and the stains, we can do something about.
Right. The sphere of beard looking as bad as spots and stains, accepting the fact that it's equally as mm-hmm. abhorrent to someone who's looking at it,
mm-hmm.
but... Okay, there is a halacha not to shave, but there's
right.
but there's not a halacha to keep your clothes dirty for except not
yeah.
practically there's no halacha.
Right, exactly.
But since there is a basis in halacha, you don't have to worry that you look strange. Even if it's equal to people seeing you as if you're wearing dirty clothes.
No, I don't think it is. Factually, I don't think it is, provided if you're extra careful to shine your shoes twice a day during sleep. I don't think that it will strike them that way. A general unkempt impression will, and a beard, a couple of days' growth can contribute to that. But when you are otherwise spotless and immaculate, the beard will look incongruous, but won't look dirty. They'll realize it. And secondly, I think that you should explain, insofar as possible, and it won't take them terribly long to figure out. To find out about the sphere.
It would be appropriate to say the not shaving is because it's a religious observance.
Yes, yeah. This is a symbol of mourning. This is a period of Jewish mourning. Mm-hmm.
Then it could turn to a kiddush.
Of course. There's no way you can change a spot into a kiddush.
I don't want to hopscotch around on the topic, and the hour's getting late, so I just want to... Will we be returning to the abortion issue tomorrow night again?
We're almost finished with the only question we didn't really answer is there any difference between sterilization and abortion in terms of whom you can do it for? You said if the mother's life were endangered, you could do abortion, but not the health. Does that apply to sterilization as well?
Not necessarily. Sterilization becomes a rather complicated problem, particularly since many Achrayim maintain that female sterilization is a drabono, not a deraisa. Then if you add to that the Rishonim who maintain that all the Rabbonim are permissible for reasons of health, it turns out that you'll find materium for female sterilization for considerations of maternal health alone. Now, that's not absolute by any means. There's a great deal of disagreement.
I'm talking
about Jewish women primarily. If there's no issur of, again, in terms of the victim of sterilization, it makes no difference whether it's a Jew or non-Jew. whatever you cannot do to a Jewish woman, you cannot do to a non-Jewish woman. The Isser of Sirus is one and the same for Jew and non-Jew. In fact, it includes animals. It's the prohibition against castration of any creature. So that there are a series of tshuvas that dealt with the question of mentally retarded women and the permissibility of sterilization. Some matirim and some who disagreed. Some were willing to permit on the basis of these two main considerations. One is nisut ravonon, B, that her health is going to be impaired thereby, since she's not going to be able to take care of the children. And others disagreed and maintained that that wasn't sufficient grounds for permitting sterilization of females. Male sterilization is a much more serious affair.
So what's the bottom line?
Bottom line, are the people here doing sterilization on a day-to-day basis? I hope not.
The requests for it are on a day-to-day basis.
Sure, but the requests are the requests that you get on a day-to-day basis are frivolous. The requests are for sterilization, particularly tubal ligation, as a birth control device. That's definitely also.
Again, I want to get back to, in terms of referral then, that one of those things where we don't even let them know who's doing it.
I wouldn't even let them know who's doing it.
A lot of times they just ask, well, what department do I call?
I would shrug my shoulders and...
What would happen practically is, very soon, there would be a number of complaints saying that, you know, those guys that are wearing the yarmulkes, they've consistently been obstructive in patients acquiring their rights within our group.
As Rabbi Shuskin said before, that's a problem.
But you're saying, say nothing.
Not him for say, problems.
you can't direct them to anyone who would direct them.
I don't think you should direct them, by any means.
Could Rabbi Hecht be part of this? Can you direct him to him or something? Department that he has, for, you know, I don't know, make up a name that sounds all right. Holistic medicine department.
Now, for a non-Jewish woman, in terms of her health, it would be more lenient.
Yes, but again, I don't think you should perform it on a non-Jewish woman.
Jewish doctor shouldn't perform.
Right.
A non-Jewish doctor could perform. Right. How about abortion? I'm expecting the same question. Did the laws concerning abortion pertain to non-Jewish women exactly the same?
With more stringency.
More stringency.
Right. It's another one of those cases where the Catholics managed to get the Sheva Mitzvahs down pat. The halacha, the bottom line of the halacha is that for non-Jewish women, abortions are forbidden even for pikuach nefesh, even for reasons of maternal health. The Catholics, incidentally, permit it only in one set of circumstances, when it is incidental to another surgical procedure, such as a pregnant woman who has cancer of the uterus, and you have to remove the uterus, and at the same time you remove the fetus. That's called a psikra, it's a dovrashen miskavna, psikration.
Literally.
Literally. Wait, I'm not finished yet. You have not intended to eliminate the pregnancy, but there's no way you can do what you're doing without eliminating the pregnancy. But you don't intend it. It's a secondary effect. The Mokin Avram maintains that as far as the Benayach is concerned, a dovrashen miskavna is permissible even when it's a psikration, as distinct from a Jew. For a Jew, where it's a psikratia, if the secondary effect is necessarily going to follow, then it's forbidden. For a non-Jew, the Mokin Avraham and many Afarini maintain that it's absolutely permissible. That means that applying the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach to this situation, they managed to get that right too. You could remove the cancerous uterus in order to eliminate the...
Jewish woman is not allowed.
No, for the Jewish woman, it's okay. For the Jewish woman, it's okay because for the Jewish woman and the Jewish doctor performing the abortion, pikuach nefesh is enough reason to sacrifice the fetus. That means the Jewish doctor can perform an abortion on a Jewish patient. We'll keep it simple, in order to save the patient's life, the mother's life. A non-Jewish doctor could not perform the same abortion. He would have no right to perform an abortion even on a Jewish woman.
Why? For him, it's murder.
For him, it's murder. Because in the Sheva Mitzvahs, in the Noahide Code, feticide is no different from homicide.
Sure.
So when a Jewish lady has an abortion, it needs to be done by a Jewish doctor.
It should be done by a Jewish doctor. Now, there are achrenim who say, what if you don't have a Jewish doctor? You can tell the non-Jewish doctor to do it, because that's only lifnei iver. That's a drabon. That's a drais, it's a lot.
What's the lifnei
iver? Placing the stumbling block before the blind. You have violated a biblical commandment, but that is permissible to save the Jewish woman's life. If the non-Jewish doctor will come ask the same Rav of the Shaila, the Rav will have to tell him he can't do it. In other words, you've got something a little paradoxical. You can ask him to do it, but if he asks you, am I allowed to do it, you have to tell him no.
A non-Jewish doctor can perform
an abortion.
An abortion on a non-Jewish woman.
Or a Jewish woman, no difference. For him, it's murder. Again, in terms of the bottom line, if you have a Jewish patient whose life is in danger and requires an abortion, refer her to a Jewish obstetrician or Jewish gynecologist. If you never refer a patient to a non-Jewish doctor for an abortion, if you can avoid it. Never refer any woman for an abortion unless there's a situation of pikuach nefesh. And even then, I would advise it only in the case of Jewish patients.
Are you under any obligation to stop your non-Jewish, or try to stop your non-Jewish colleagues from doing these things?
Again, two answers. One, the technical answer. There is no halacha of hecheyach techeyach. You don't have to prevent non-Jews from doing averis. You just cannot aid and abet them in committing transgressions. That's in terms of the technical halacha. In terms of general policy, by all means, you should let them know you don't approve. Certainly not by making referrals for elective abortions.
Did you have any questions? That was
On this point of you don't have to... you don't have to stop them. I'm wondering, you mentioned the Rambam before about the Eretz Yisrael, they don't have any courts, so we're supposed to stop it because it'll affect the Jews. I'm wondering, I know the Rebbe has spoken a lot about Shevi Mitzvahs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, there is no halacha that says, Achei Techir Chagoy. But since that you have to reprimand the guy, okay? It's only by Jews. But since, at least philosophically, Hashem wants the mitzvahs of the Shevanah, He wants them to observe it.
Yes.
Is it not then definitely some kind of a moral obligation to encourage them to do that?
Precisely what I said before. That even though there may not be a technical obligation, certainly we know what the Rebbeinu Shlomo wants. And we shouldn't be engaged in policies which lead to exactly the opposite. Plus... the reflection in terms of Jews, so what happens in the non-Jewish community is very quickly going to happen in the Jewish community. If you encourage them to have abortions, then there are going to be more Jewish fetuses that are aborted. You encourage birth control among non-Jews, then obviously there's going to be more birth control among Jews.
Let me get one other thing straight. A non-Jewish woman whose life is threatened by a pregnancy cannot have an abortion done at all, even by a Jewish doctor.
She couldn't aid and assist in the abortion. Technically, if the Jewish doctor were to put her under anesthesia and perform the abortion, there wouldn't be a prohibition.
Can you foresee any anti-abortion amendment that might pass that would be too stringent? In other words, one that would... be opposed to the halacha and therefore not permit abortion.
Yes, well, theoretically there could be an anti-abortion amendment that wouldn't permit abortion even when the pregnancy endangers the life of the mother, theoretically. I myself was present, goes back now 5 or 6 years, at a Senate hearing that was taking, Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, it was taking testimony on an abortion amendment. There were a number of people testifying. There were what I called four cardinals and one sparrow. I was the sparrow. There were four cardinals. The four cardinals testified before me, and they didn't prepare themselves terribly well. one of the senators asked, the text hadn't been formulated, one of the senators asked whether they'd be willing to accept an amendment that provided for an abortion only in cases when the mother's life is endangered. Clearly, they could not accept that, at least theologically. In terms of canon law, that's osur. They can't say it's mutter. And these characters, who will commit to the grace of carpentry cap, they should have known that's the elementary question. The first question they're going to be asked, you've got to have an answer ready, whatever the answer is going to be. So these four characters sit around in a row at the table, and they turn to each other and have a consultation on the spot to decide what they're going to answer. And they decided that they will not oppose such an amendment. I mean, look, bottom line, they know that you will never get an amendment passed that forbids abortion when the pregnancy threatens the mother's life. Therefore, they won't oppose that amendment. It's half a loaf of bread. It's 90% of a loaf instead of the whole loaf. They'll settle for that, too. I'm not terribly concerned. I wouldn't care if there was a blanket prohibition of abortion, even when it endangers the life of the mother, because I know very well that Jewish women whose lives are endangered will manage to have the abortion, and it will be done under proper circumstances. I'm not worried about what's going to happen to those individuals under those circumstances. That's because I'm perfectly willing to be matir an abortion of those circumstances, even if there is a constitutional amendment that says it's also. I'm not fazed by the constitutional amendment. So you know, the answer to your question, can I conceive of such a set of circumstances? Not in this world. It's not going to happen. And if it did happen, I wouldn't be terribly upset. It wouldn't make any difference. It would, as Rabbi Schusterman said, present a problem, but not an insurmountable one. That kind of problem we could deal with. I answered the same question a little bit differently. They asked me the same question a little bit afterwards. I proceeded to tell them that I am not here to write the text of an amendment. I'm here to give them advice with regard to an ancient tradition of morality, and I rely upon their good sense in terms of framing the text of the amendment. That's called a kappa.
Does that answer your question, Mike? Okay, I think the hour is getting late. Most of the other questions that have already been submitted in writing would apply to a general audience, and I think if everybody is asking, we'll hold those for tomorrow, midstream, which the session will be held at the shul. We thank you very, very, very much for coming.
Give me the address of the shul.
And
Before we close, I have another question that's down here that I don't want to bring up anymore. I'm not sure what the answer is, despite what you told us already. How do we deal with our homosexual patients? Should we make it clear to them that this is completely out of bounds, it's immoral, and that any general care that we give them is
I don't mind dealing with it tomorrow. I think in general you have to do two things. A, you have to make it very clear where you stand. That you do not view this as simply an alternate lifestyle. And B, any therapy should be in the form of behavior modification. It should be very clear in your mind, at least, and I would hope in the mind of the patient as well, that what you're trying to do is not to make him comfortable with his homosexuality, but you're trying to reverse it.
Is this your question, or is your question somebody who comes in with a cold and happens to be homosexual?
Yeah, actually. Right, actually. It's a little more than that, in that you're assuming responsibility as family doctor.
Right.
we can avoid the issue of, do you feel comfortable with your sexual orientation? We can avoid that. But just from day to day, it seems to me sometimes, if I don't say anything about it, and it's obvious that he's a homosexual, It seems to me that maybe I'm giving him tacit approval that, oh, this is okay with me, and I'm a nice guy to you, and you're a nice guy to me.
I think it would be appropriate to suggest to him referral to a psychiatrist, provided that you can find a psychiatrist who's willing to give the proper treatment. that's hard. If you don't have that, then there's very little you can do about it.
Yeah, it seems only if the patient specifically requests help from a psychiatrist.
Well, again, when you're dealing with a Jewish patient, I think you should make it very clear that he ought to go look for such a psychiatrist. And maybe you ought to help him look for it. even with regard to non-Jewish patients, I don't think you have to volunteer information unless it comes up directly. And most of these cases, you're going to deduce the fact. You're not going to have the facts presented to you on a silver platter. And when they are, I think you should voice disapproval, even if it's only mild disapproval. I think it should be clear. In the case of Jewish patients, I think that you ought to have a psychiatrist on tap who's willing to engage in behavior modification therapy.
Can you then continue to treat the patient for his for the problems that result from this pattern of behavior or the genital infection?
The problems are going to come to him as a family physician are going to be ones that he has to treat, literally. I mean, what's going to happen? He's going to contract some kind of venereal disease. Shall he not treat the venereal disease? That's a death sentence.
But, I mean, he's from one side telling the patient stuff and
No, you tell the patient, look, you've got venereal disease. I've told you I'm going to cure it, and I'm going to tell you how not to get reinfected.
Mm-hmm. Is this applied to female homosexuality as well as men?
Yes.
Is there a distinction in halacha?
Yes.
Is it much worse for male?
Yes.
But we're only talking in terms of our general moral responsibility anyhow, so therefore right, we make a difference between
the severity of the infraction is irrelevant. What difference does it make? Your response should be the same.
Good. And that lends directly to counseling or treating single patients, you know, both Jewish and non-Jewish, or engage in heterosexual behavior, whatever the law is.
I don't think you ought to give them sexual counseling. I mean, I don't think you ought to make it easier for them. Clearly, when they come to you with venereal disease, you're going to have to treat the venereal disease.
Birth control.
Birth control, particularly the pill, is hard for a very simple reason. There's another question that has to be answered first. Will prescribing the pill have the slightest effect upon the sexual activity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That depends upon your patient population.
Usually.
Mm, depends. I don't know who your patients are. If you're in a mill town dealing with lower socioeconomic bracket people, I guarantee you will have absolutely zilch effect. They will do whatever they will do with birth control or without birth control. It'll have an effect on the number of pregnancies, children born out of wedlock. If you're dealing with upper middle class people, it also will have no effect, but you'll get the message across. It'll have no effect because they'll go next door. They're smart enough for that. They know they can get it. I don't think that you should prescribe birth control pills for the kind of people that you see. At least the kind of people I assume.
Well, what you're saying, would there be a circumstance where you could, other than again for the sake of the danger to the life of the mother?
For non-Jews, again, what are we talking about here?
We're talking about non-Jews,
I hope.
Right, well, Jews and non-Jews, but for non-Jews, you said we should be treating them essentially the same way.
Yes, except that, let's put it this way. I don't think that you ought to prescribe birth control pills, because prescribing birth control pills, in effect, is giving a seal of approval to premarital sexual activity.
Is that not permissible for non-Jews?
Is premarital sexual activity not permissible for non-Jews? It may be permissible, but I don't want you to tell them that.
They're really using the concept of fiduciary non-Jews.
Yes, precisely. However, promiscuity among non-Jews is also for many Rishonim. Many Rishonim maintain that one contact establishes the equivalent of matrimony. Again, that's a minority opinion. Otherwise, it's absolutely correct. For most Rishonim, premarital sex is not forbidden to non-Jews. By the same token, I don't think that that's something that you want to announce from the rafters, and I don't think that that's something that you want to promote as a matter of policy.
Only because that will come back on the
news. Yeah, sure. You know, this whole concept of morality. And I think that you ought to be clear where you stand on that. in terms of Jewish patients, quite apart. Now, this is policy. You know, in terms of policy, I think it's clear. In terms of the shaila, you know, the basic halacha in terms of Jewish patients, if the birth control pills are freely available elsewhere, there wouldn't be an issue. If they aren't freely available elsewhere, then there may be a real difnei.
Jewish?
A Jewish patient, yes. But I presume we're dealing with a situation where it is freely available elsewhere. They don't get it from you, they can get it from someplace else. I don't know. I mean, it depends upon the situation.
Are you saying that if there were no one else...
No, again, I'm saying that as a matter of policy, it certainly shouldn't be done. In terms of technical halacha, in a hypothetical situation where they won't get it someplace else, and these middle-class Jews are smart enough not to do it unless they get the birth control bill. Under those circumstances, it's a lifnei'iver, and you shouldn't be, and it would be technically also an halacha as well.
What is the heter to give it otherwise?
The heter to give...
To give it in a situation where they're available.
Where it's freely available, where they can get it anywhere, then we're not dealing with a lifnei'iver.
Yes, but why are you giving this... For the, it's not the health of the mother. Why are you giving this lady birth control pills, whether she's married or not? She's Jewish.
I'm a druggist selling it. I'm giving it to her because she asked for it. You know? She paid her fee and she wants her pill.
I thought we said it.
I agree with you. I said, I'm answering on two levels. In terms of policy, absolutely not. In terms of halacha, it depends on the circumstances. There may be some circumstances in which it's absolutely usher. In other circumstances, it may not be usher. But as policy, I certainly think you should.
In other words, it doesn't constitute sterilization.
No, the pill is not sterilization. It will certainly not stay over.
Well, one last child, would it be appropriate to mention at this time that those who think they should make an alimony, those who didn't have a marriage should remember that they have a marriage?
I think we have a minion, yes.
Oh, do we all didn't have a marriage?
We started before the Shkia.
We have a minion, Shia.
We have a minion, I don't know if everybody has a diamond. Thank you very much, Rabbi. We continue the mission tomorrow, 7:30.
The shul is 39.